As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Champions League. Red not dead redemption for Onana and Maguire at Old Trafford, while Dortmund give Magpies one for sorrow at St James's. As Rick said, we'll always have Paris. We round up the midweek action, marvel over Zaire Emery, and look ahead to the weekend with the Manchester derby and the return of the worst game in the history of the Premier League. All that and more in this Totally Football Show. Listener, thank you for joining us. And on Totally today, Duncan Alexander.
Hello, James.
Also, Michael Cox.
Hi, James.
And fresh in from Champions League land, Raphael Honigstein.
Hello, James.
Your mind's still crackling with the sights and sounds of a busy midweek match day, eh, Raph?
Yeah, it was good. Especially Wednesday.
Did you like Wednesday?
I liked Wednesday a lot.
What did you like about Wednesday?
Well, I was mostly watching Newcastle Dortmund, which was a wonderful game. Especially if you have German inclinations, very, very successful. PSG Milan looked good from what I saw. There were lots of goals on Wednesday.
Yeah, there were some goals. More than on Tuesday. Michael, did you anything you enjoyed midweek?
Quite enjoyed the Arsenal game. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just quite good intensity. And yeah, Wednesday, just loads of goals. It was like Boxing Day 1963.
Really? Mm. Was it that many goals? How many goals were
I mean,
scored?
Not quite, but it felt like a lot of goals.
It felt like a lot because of Tuesday, I suspect.
Yeah, by comparison.
Headlines from a round of 16 matches. Well, Bayern Munich, Manchester City, Barcelona, Real all continued their perfect starts. Man United won a Champions League match. That's only their second in their last six. 1-0 at home to Copenhagen. Celtic, who without a home win in the Champions League for almost a decade, took the lead twice against Atletico Madrid, but still only ended up with just a point. And in the fearsome Group F, tables were turning. PSG going top now of the group after beating Milan 3-0, while Newcastle dropped to third after defeat at home to Dortmund. Let's start with how Borussia burst Newcastle's bubble.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Schlotterbeck macht mit, drüben Füllkrug, und das ist Matcher! Dortmund führt!
Rough. The crowd were all there, all fired up at St James's for another big night after that PSG win. What did Dortmund do?
Dortmund did something that we've rarely seen from Dortmund, which is to turn up and be resilient and play with maturity, play with conviction, great work rate, on the ball they were really good. Everything that PSG weren't, everything that they weren't when they played at Paris, were very meek. And also, I think Newcastle were caught out a little bit. They were very, very open. Lots of counter-attacking opportunities for Dortmund. And they took one of them. And in the second half, then, they had to dig deep. And Newcastle probably earned a draw. Or did enough to get a draw, at least. But Dortmund had earned, by contrast, or conversely, I should say, their luck, I think, on the night by turning up for once. And I'm writing about this game and I looked back. When was the last big away win for a Dortmund team in the Champions League against a proper side? And I went back all the way to 2002 and 3 when they won 1-0 at Milan. You did have a 2-1 win at Arsenal, but that was late Wenger era Arsenal, where who were frankly shambolic in the Champions League in 2013-14. Yes, there was a 4-1 at Seville, but a proper big European occasion. That's the biggest win I could find in over 20 years. And that explains why I think we're so surprised and pleasantly surprised, because this Dortmund team have developed a reputation for being a little bit meek, a little bit weak, fragile, and they were none of these things, which made it a historic night.
Indeed. Very different approach to PSG's. They handed Newcastle the possession and the Magpies came unstuck. A bad night for Newcastle, because they also lost Alexander Isak to a groin injury after 15 minutes. Jacob Murphy came on, but dislocated his shoulder. He'll be out for a while. And we also saw a cameo from Sandro Tonali, who is set possibly today to be starting his lung spell out of the game.
He did all right when he came on, but I think losing Isak was the key moment. I mean, if you look at like momentum graphs, Newcastle probably had the lion's share of the first 15 minutes. And it's an issue with Isak. He's a very good player, but he does get injured a lot. And as Raf said, from then on, Dortmund just grew into the game. And yeah, all right, Newcastle hit the bar quite a lot at the end. But it felt a little bit like all the stuff that worked against PSG, you know, whipping up the crowd. We saw again, you know, a lot of players celebrating winning throw-ins and stuff. And it just, it feels like you can only do that once a season. It's like, it's a magical power that mustn't be, a bit like the ring, Frodo's ring.
Or when you call a friend in who wants to be a millionaire.
Yeah, yeah, they phoned a friend against PSG and...
Well, Arsene Wenger had a theory that you could only really lose it with the players in the dressing room once a season. Because if you did it more than that, it would lose its effect. Mm. I can't imagine Wenger doing that much at all.
Mm.
But he was like, yeah, once a season max. Otherwise, it becomes a bit of a charade.
Mm. Yeah. And we said after the last set of games that although they'd beaten PSG, the group is so tough that it didn't necessarily put them in a good position. And here we are.
Are you forecasting more twists and turns ahead?
In the group of DF, yeah. They've obviously got two away games now. Yeah. Difficult away games. So... it's definitely a learning experience.
Yeah. One of those games is against Borussia Dortmund, the Signal Iduna Park. And then the other's at Parc des Princes, where Wednesday night, Paris Saint-Germain shook off their St. James's shellacking in some style with a 3-0 victory over Milan. Goals from Mbappe and Colomwani and Kang-in Lee. But, ooh, a man of the match performance from Mr. Assister, Warren Zaire-Emery. How excited is Jules about Warren Zaire-Emery?
It doesn't take much to get Jules excited about PSG player or anything connected with PSG. But in this case, I understand his enthusiasm, because the kid is 17. Already played last year in the, last season, I should say, in the last 16 game against Bayern. Looked a little bit immature, or perhaps overawed by the occasion, but this season, very, very impressive. Very impressive player. Wonderful player. And, you know, one of the reasons why nobody mentions the name Verratti anymore in Paris.
What's so wonderful about Warren?
I just like his poise. He always seems to have time on the ball, takes the right decision, makes the game flow, takes the easy passes, doesn't give the ball away. Everything you want from a central midfielder.
Well, yeah.
He's pretty strong.
Do you know he's currently leading the Champions League for assists? He's got three now. Extraordinary, 17 years of age.
He's younger than Deal or No Deal, the TV programme, which puts it into perspective.
The classic yardstick for a young player.
Can't believe it. Birmingham should retire number 33 in honour of him, I think. That's how good he is.
Very nice. Is it just me, or are young prodigies just getting younger and younger? I don't know. Michael, you after this podcast, are going to do another one about players who peak at different ages, he said, segueing very neatly into that.
Yeah, I am. I spent a good couple of days doing an article this week, basically finding strikers who...
Oh, it's strikers?
Well, it's mainly strikers.
Right.
But it's 17 strikers who enjoyed their best goal-scoring season at different ages.
Have
all the
got
way from
one
19.
For each age?
Yeah,
one, have you?
All the way from 19 to 35. Because people always say strikers peak like late 20s.
Right.
And that is the average.
Who peaked at 19?
The original Ronaldo, I've got. Yeah.
Oh,
and that season at Barcelona. And there's some good graphs. If you like graphs,
yes,
then don't listen to the podcast. Just read the article.
Right.
If you don't like graphs, listen to the podcast.
And that's the Football Tactics podcast.
It is, yeah.
Not really tactics, though, is it, Mike?
No. The name's constrained us a bit. Or not. Yeah.
Why peak, should call it peak performance.
Yeah, get Gordon Ramsay on.
I think massive cocks would have been good.
Yeah, we'd have brought in the clip. I think, but yeah, rejected.
At the other end of the scale, the 35-year-old is?
One of your favourites, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, one of everyone's favourites, surely, yeah. Fabio Quagliarella.
Yeah, so he was 35, at the start of the season, he was 35.
Right.
When he had his best ever goal-scoring season. Adariz for Athletic Bilbao.
I mean, numerically, well. Although I think some of his finest goals were scored, I think, was it 06, 07?
Well, that's the funny thing. He kind of went from a scorer of great goals to a great goal scorer, fair. Didn't he? Yeah. But certainly in terms of the raw numbers, he peaked, funnily enough, the season when Cristiano Ronaldo joined Serie A.
Oh, yeah.
So it was pretty impressive to get the Capo Canonieri.
There's some that you think, you read it and you're like, that makes sense, like Robbie Fowler at 20. Mm. There's some, like Diego Costa's much earlier than I would have thought. Mm. But the numbers back it up and you can't argue with the numbers.
No, you can't, can you? Any other surprises or do you want to save them for the Cox Unlimited podcast? Sorry, tactics.
Not any surprises necessarily, but I think I kind of gone through and found quotes from players about like why they peaked at different times. And
right. Well, there's some poignant stories in there.
Kind of. A lot of the early ones were obviously very, very quick players who then got a lot of muscle injuries.
Right.
Which is quite sad.
Michael Owen?
He's actually not one because he had a few seasons where he scored like the same amount. So the graph would look boring. But okay. Robbie Fowler, similar case. Andy Cole, similar case.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm.
Excellent. Hey, Celtic, who caught there? Stirring performance against Atletico Madrid on what day was that? Was that Wednesday? That was Wednesday.
It was yesterday, yes. We saw bits of it.
We did.
They looked very impressive on the ball.
Well, Horncastle was saying it's the best football he's seen in the Champions League this season.
He has been watching a lot of
Italian teams. But poor Celtic took the lead twice against Atletico Madrid. There was a lot of build up to this game about a very bitter encounter from 1974.
I saw the YouTube clip. Mm. It's brilliant. It's worth watching.
It is, but there's a lot of Celtic players going in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And the thing was that the Glaswegian press described Atletico as animals and they disgraced football because every single Atletico player back in 1974 got carded. Three of them were sent off.
But
course of two legs, though, no?
I believe it was in the one game.
Really?
I might be wrong about that. But anyway, it was a fierce encounter.
So you mean that was kind of... different incidents. It wasn't like the referee ceremony.
Oh, no. It wasn't one big melee.
Okay, right.
The home side's version was that Atletico basically filled their team with bruisers and went in to kind of put reducers on the various boys' talents in the hope of setting up the second leg and then bringing the better players back. And indeed, they won 2-0 in Madrid, went through to the final. And promptly lost that. Atletico Madrid choosing
well,
to...
Well, no, they didn't promptly lose it, James.
Oh.
Because it went into a replay.
Ah, fair point. Thank you. Anyway, this week, Atletico Madrid choosing to honour that performance in 1974 away to Celtic by wearing the exact same strip that they'd
was
sported
that
night. Yeah.
I was wondering when I watched that.
Yeah, magnificent trolling.
That's great. I didn't know that.
That is great. Like... Teams will do it for like winning trophies and stuff, but that is the most Atletico Madrid thing I've ever
heard. Very Diego Simeone, isn't it?
Yeah.
The thing I enjoyed about this game, and of course Celtic Park, European Nights, atmosphere is really good. There's a couple of great crowd sound effects. I don't know if you noticed this, because there was the Griezmann save penalty in the rebound, with an incredible roar and then complete silence. Mm. And then for the second goal scored by Palmer, when he hit it, there was just half a second of complete silence before it hit the post and went in. I don't know whether producer Charlie can find those sound effects or whether he cares, but I thought it was great.
I wonder if he can play in a little bit of silence, that specific silence.
Just the silence.
Mm. Cholo's team, anyway, twice went behind against Celtic, but pegged it back to 2-2 to stay very much in the hunt for a qualifying spot. Their second... a point behind Feyenoord, while Celtic remained bottom of the group with just the 1 point. Yikes. All right, what else happened? Bayern got pummeled. Rafa's still counting up the yellow cards in the 1974 clash, topically enough. What have you got, Rafa?
Well, I got 12 yellow cards for Atletico.
Right, and there were three reds.
The two subs.
Were they some of yellows or not?
Yeah, there were yellows as well.
All right.
But it says here Adelardo did not get a yellow card, so I'm not sure.
Oh, okay, maybe one player.
How that works out.
I have to imagine he felt hell when he got back to the dressing room.
I know it does work out because the keeper, Reina, who's Pepe Reina's father,
nice.
Also got yellow carded. So.
Did he?
So 12 yellow cards, but one escaped.
Anyway.
Adelardo, he was a very fair player.
Possibly so, Raf. tell us about Bayern Munich. Another win for them. They're unbeaten now in the group stages in 37 matches. They've won the last 16, although it was a bit shaky this time, away in Istanbul.
Yeah, they were really under pressure. I think Istanbul had 16 shots. Apparently, that's the worst Bayern defensive performance in many, many years in the Champions League. But they got lucky. Sven Ulreich was very good as well. And then in the second half, they took their chances and you could see the energy just dropping a little bit from Istanbul. But Thomas Tuchel was unapologetic. He said, you know, this is a team that hadn't lost in 17 consecutive home games. And you had to ride the storm. You had to cope with the noise. Apparently, it was incessant whistling throughout. Harry Kane said afterwards, I still haven't quite got my hearing back. He was talking to the media. And in a way, it's a little bit by design, this Bayern passivity, if you want to call it weakness, because they, under Tuchel, like to have teams come onto them, ideally defend better than they did, but they often look as if they're a little bit under the cosh, only to then create space for themselves and counterattack quite effectively. And that was really the story of the game once more. So, very good result. Fits into a good spell of results. Really throughout the season. But yet the football poses sort of a few questions that I think haven't been answered yet.
What questions are they, Raf?
Well, the question is, can you play with this team so... It's not defensive, but can you be so passive and so deep? But at the same time, defend well? Because I think for this Bayern team, dropping deep and waiting for things to kind of break down for the opposition can... bleed into a pretty passive approach, and then they concede too many chances for my liking. I think they're better when they attack higher up the pitch, but Tuchel has decided to play that way, and so far it works out. But it explains also his fascination, perhaps some people at Bayern would say obsession, with having a holding midfielder, because usually Bayern have so much of the ball, you think, why do you need a defensive midfielder for this team? Well, this Bayern team have relatively little of the ball, and you need somebody who protects the back four more effectively than Kimmich and Goretzka, whoever plays next to him, do so. I understand why Tuchel's been banging this particular drum so much.
Yeah, just to sort of back up the point that it was quite an end-to-end game. There were 12 big chances in this game, 7 for Galatasaray, 5 for Bayern. Galatasaray missing 6 of theirs. That's by far the most in any game this season. So it was just end-to-end, wasn't it?
Also, continuing their perfect start, Real Madrid and Barcelona, who will be facing each other this Sunday in the Clásico. Barcelona beating Shakhtar 2-1. Real Madrid defeated Braga on Tuesday. Was that 2-1 in the end, was it? 2-1? Yes, it was. And Jude Bellingham, who didn't score at the weekend, did get what turned out to be the winner in Portugal. That's his 11th of the season. Crikey. Manchester City won 3-1 at Young Boys, with Erling Haaland ending his 5-game goal drought. Got a brace, a penalty, and a gorgeous second. Did you like his second goal, Mug?
Very nice goal, yeah.
They did concede again, Manchester City. But look at this. You mentioned the number of chances that Bayern Munich have had. Do you know how many shots City have had in their 3 games so far? 81. I mean, I'm no expert, but that sounds like a lot of shots. Big game for City, of course, this weekend, as they take on Man United, who also won in the Champions League. We'll get some thoughts on their game Tuesday against Copenhagen and the Derby next.
Football is bigger and more complicated than ever before. Just ask VAR.
Check complete. It's fine. Perfect. Yeah.
So the Daily Football Briefing is here to help, whether it's the World Cup.
It's a kind of face-saving. Everyone's happy. No one's a loser.
Lionel Messi.
As they say, he completed football.
Or Manchester United.
I mean, the performances all season have been questionable.
That are making you quizzical. The Daily Football Briefing has all the answers you need for every football story that matters, and it does exactly what the name suggests. It's daily, it's brief, and it's all about football. The Daily Football Briefing from The Athletic, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Larson against Onana.
It's a big derby on Sunday at Old Trafford, where on Tuesday night, Man United were victorious against Copenhagen. Rafa, you watched this game.
Watched the game.
Harry Maguire gazed on the lead. Then another of the more popular players, Andre Onana, proved the hero of that dramatic finale. Talk us through it.
Well, it was very dramatic because what looked like the late winner from Harry Maguire, of all players, much maligned, of course. Brilliant header, has to be said. Also a very good cross, I think, from Eriksen to set up the goal. Substitution that really worked for Ten Hag. But then, of course, Scott McTominay gives away a penalty in the dying seconds.
Who steps up to take it?
The son of Henrik Larsson, Jordan Larsson. Is he named after Michael Jordan, I wonder? I don't know.
Jordan.
And Andre Onana, brilliant one-handed save to secure all 3 points for United. We were absolutely desperate for those points because they'd lost the first two games at home to Copenhagen. Didn't look for a long time as if they'd be winning because they didn't really create much. It was a pretty ropey performance. I think the manner of the win will feel very positive because it happened late and then Onana made that fantastic save and there's a lot of positive momentum. The crowd were really up for it. Players were celebrating with Onana, which was really, I think, touching to see. And you could tell that they like him and wanted to support him.
I mean, he had just saved a penalty.
No, but I think there was an extra element of, right. You know, you showed them, we love you, sort of heartwarming togetherness.
Could be the making of this dressing room, you feel?
Certainly the making of Onana, I think. He's changed perception with that single save already to an extent. But United were pretty bad throughout the game.
It's nice for United that they got a win in the Champions League after almost 2 years, but it was a 1-0 victory against a side that's collected 1 point in the last decade in the Champions League.
Yeah. I mean, this Copenhagen team are not bad. We've seen that. Away to Istanbul, they had the lead until they had a player sent off. They gave Bayern a real scare in Copenhagen. And Bayern came back from, I think, being 1-0 down and needed a lot of hard work to win that game. So, but still, just judging United on their own terms, there was so little happening. I mean, Antony was completely ineffective. The midfield looked very uninspired. Hoyland had almost nothing to work with. I mean, he was working hard and holding up the ball well as ever, but had no real opportunity that I can remember.
Are we anywhere different to where we were under Solskjaer?
Yeah, we are. Of course it's different. It's different because Ten Hag has been able to buy the players that he wanted. And I think, to quote Jurgen Klopp, a bad plan is still better than no plan at all.
Wow.
And I think this United team have given Ten Hag the keys to Old Trafford and Carrington and said, you put your team together. And while it's still not perfect in terms of recruitment, at least he's buying the player that he wants and he's playing or is beginning to play the kind of football that he wants. And I think that bodes better than this mishmash that they had before when it was even sort of implicit policy to buy a squad that could work for any style and any manager, which is a novel idea, an interesting one, but I don't think really worked in practice so well.
Mm. Michael, speaking of changing perceptions, Harry Maguire, previously target of much opprobrium, but I keep reading positive things about him now, and indeed he's played 17 games for United, lost 17 he's played. They've won 16 of them. How has he become key?
Is that true?
He keeps referencing it as well. So I've not seen someone reference win percentages as much for a long time. And it's slightly skewed, obviously. Yeah, maybe. But because he does tend to, he has recently been playing in lesser games. But it is good to see him overcome his difficulties. And there was a nice interview at the end with him and Onana both having come through.
Was he leaning on the wall?
He wasn't leaning this time, no. Right. But he was the club captain. He's been paid a lot of money, cost a lot of money, but it must have been for him personally, it must have been a tough year. And I mean, I don't think he's the right player for that team necessarily, but he's at least doing a job.
Is there something different about the way Ten Hag's using him?
Not really. No. I mean, I think this is one of those occasions where someone's probably used the headline, silenced his critics. Whereas I don't think any critics would say, yeah, you can't score headers from set pieces. You know, obviously it's a small part of his job, but he is very good at that. He's a very good aerial target in the opposition box.
Mm.
Just the defensive part.
Well, he wants to play on the left-hand side of the central defence, and Ten Hag won't play him there, just plays him on the right. So
That business of him scoring, though, we had the stat on Tuesday that was his first goal since, was it February 2022? And in the interim, he'd scored 3 own goals, of course.
It evens out.
I mean, it does. Almost.
I think there's a massive overreaction against him. Mm. He's definitely not a bad player. He might not be the kind of captain that United supporters dream about.
Mm.
And he does have weaknesses and problems. But I don't think he's ever been a bad centre-back.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations where he's been made into this figure. And I was looking at Gazzetta.
Oh, yeah.
Before the England-Italy game, and Italian comments below the sort of preview were sort of, well, look at all the forwards England have got. And then they were all like, oh, but Maguire's playing, so we'll be fine. So, like, the fact that it's translated into a different country is unfair on him, definitely.
Yeah, who had the last laugh that night?
Exactly.
Exactly. Man United, third place in the group, Bayern runaway leaders with 9. And you've got Galatasaray only a point ahead of Man United. We'll be visiting Copenhagen next. And, of course, they've got the trip to Istanbul to come. Oh, that's going to be key. Oof. Anyway, before any of that, they got the derby this weekend. Fresh from 3 straight victories, Man United, welcoming Man City to Old Trafford for a fixture that United actually won last time. Do you remember this? Again,
yeah.
Hinged on that
big turnaround.
Controversial Bruno Fernandes goal with the Marcus Rashford offside, not offside. Well, Duncan, you've been ranking derbies for us over the last few weeks. North London derby, very much your top.
Yeah.
Merseyside derby is all right, but only if it's played at Goodison.
Yeah.
What's your feeling about Manchester derbies at Old Trafford?
I'd say they tend to be better at Old Trafford than the Etihad.
All right.
It's a strange derby in the sense that at the start of the Premier League era, United was so much better than City, obviously, and didn't lose for years. Then there was the Sean Gota, Gary Neville being crossed at Peter Schmeichel game at Main Road. And obviously recently there's been a weird trend where City have been really good at Old Trafford last year, accepted, and United have been pretty good at the Etihad. So has seen a lot of away wins. Yeah, it's a pretty good game. It's an unusual but good time slot.
Mm. Why is it at 3:30 on Sunday afternoon?
The police didn't like 4:30, but apparently 1 hour earlier is better. What about two?
Well, just that's another regular time slot on Sunday. Because instead,
I think that would have clashed with the other 2 o'clock kickoffs.
Right.
Because this is the main pick.
Well, I think it'd be
because,
the Super Sunday, 4:30, and they're like, 4:30 is fine. Although the clocks do go back, so technically it's 4:30.
But it's just the worst weekend for it, isn't it? Because I think people will look at their kind of foot mob app or whatever
app
they
haven't factored.
Yeah, exactly. But that's a 4:30 kickoff. They got that wrong. Someone's going to make that mistake.
So tune in for the first half and get ahead of the public.
Wow. My hot take on Premier League derbies is that at the moment all the derbies kind of involve one of the top clubs. So there's kind of bigger things at stake. Whereas what I miss is a kind of Southampton, Portsmouth, Villa Birmingham.
But Villa Birmingham, yeah.
Newcastle, Sunderland, Cardiff, Swansea. Yeah. Games where, like, as a neutral, you tune in and be like, I'll just get really invested in this for a couple of hours. And yeah. I think the lack of them is why sometimes you're looking at the televised fixtures and it feels like there's quite a lot of bad games on so far, or unappetizing fixtures so far this season.
Why have they disappeared, these?
Well, just because one of those clubs is not involved, you
I
know.
See.
But Newcastle Sunderland, that would always be on television and that'd be a massive deal.
Mm. Excellent. Should we have a look at the other games that are on this weekend?
If you like. We can reminisce about the games that used to happen, but no, it probably won't be very interesting.
Let's see. The Premier League weekend begins on Friday. Spurs, who are now 2 points clear after Monday's win against Fulham, are at Palace Friday night. Saturday, Chelsea-Brentford are the early game. Then you've got Arsenal-Sheffield United at 3, along with Bournemouth-Burnley. At 5:30 Saturday, Wolves take on Newcastle. Sunday, a bit weird, West Ham-Everton, the early game, but it's on 1 o'clock. This is big news about the clocks going back. So does that mean it's 2 o'clock in old time, or actually midday?
If you're a British summertime ultra, then it's at 2. And
okay,
So, yeah, I mean, I might just not change my clocks earlier, and pretend the police haven't got involved. So,
right.
Yeah.
We've got to do this now. David Gold is no longer with us. Because he used to do a tweet every year raging about the clocks going back.
Okay.
With messages like, stop this madness and things like that.
Yeah. It's for the Scottish farmers.
Anyway, that's on at 1 o'clock. West Ham Everton. Three games are on at 2, but none of them are televised. That's Villa Luton, Brighton Fulham, and Liverpool Forest. And then at 3:30, as mentioned, the Manchester Derby. Friday night, Crystal Palace, Spurs. Spurs, did you watch the Fulham win Monday night?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Michael?
Well, it's just weird. Like, the goals were so similar. They just had such an obvious plan to take advantage of the fact that Bassey's not very good at playing out, especially when he's on the right of a, you know, maybe Harry Maguire could. Actually, Harry Maguire's the opposite, isn't he? Because he's right foot, but likes playing on the left. Yeah. But it was so strange. I mean, so many goals these days in top-level Premier League football just come from pressing. I don't think there's that many teams who are really good at breaking down deep defences. But now almost everyone wants to play out. Pressing's such a big part of the game. And you've got to think, in some situations, I'm not saying just play Route 1 football, but you've got to relieve the pressure when you've got a player who's just so uncomfortable on the ball.
Right, thank you.
I mean, it's even more visible in the EFL because the teams are doing it there but are even less adept at playing out. And honestly, the goals per game are up because there's so many goals from turnovers on the edge of the box.
Good Lord. Are Spurs your favourite team to watch right now, Michael?
No, they are fun though, aren't they? Because they've mixed. They've got a real tactical identity, but they've also got individuals who are given a bit of freedom. I mean, Madison has been fantastic. Every game I've seen him, he's been really good. Son, after a dreadful season last time out, has got his shooting boots on. Richarlison's not playing very well, but he's still quite fun to watch because I think you kind of want him to come good.
He's matched his goal involvement total from last season already, so he's doing all right. Or he wasn't doing very well last year. But
and they got players. I mean, Bentancur's back in training. He was so good last year. I mean, he was basically their best player for a spell before he went out injured. So, no, they've been excellent.
I mean, obviously, people are saying they've had an easy start and, you know, it's not going to last. But, weirdly, if they beat Palace, they'll go 5 points clear. For a little bit, at least. They've not been five or more points clear since the end of the 1960-61 season, which is the last time they won the league.
Good Lord.
That's a long time.
Well, I remember that extraordinary stat you had about the number of days they've been on top of the Premier League. Where are we at with now? Have they overtaken Norwich?
They've not reached Norwich yet, no. They must be nearing 100 now, which is slowly eroding the quality of that stat, which is sad to see.
It's sad to see, isn't it? Like a magnificent sandcastle and the tide's coming in.
True.
Will the tide come in Friday night further?
Is it a castle built from sand, I wonder?
Wow.
Australian sand.
Yeah, and Postecoglou, a quick mention for the fact that he is currently enjoying the best start of any manager ever in the Premier League.
I mean, it will be funny if an Australian manager wins the Premier League before an English manager does. Who would have suspected?
As you mentioned, they can go 5 points clear on Friday, at least while we wait for Arsenal to take on Sheffield United. That's 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon. Arsenal were in action on Tuesday. Michael, a game you watched away in Seville. Gabriel's Jesus and Martinelli here.
Yeah, this was quite a good game. There's quite a lot going on. It's almost like there was different phases in the game. I thought Arsenal started a bit nervily. Then Gabriel Jesus, I thought, played really, really well, constantly releasing Martinelli. Obviously, the goal he scored himself was fantastic. And then Arsenal had to really hold on late in the game, which they just about did. But I think it would be a bit of outcome bias to say, oh, they've, you know, it was a real resilient display, because they were panicking late on. And that punch over his own bar from David Raya. I know he's getting a lot of focus at the moment. I don't want to pile on because I feel a bit sorry for him. But that was an extraordinary piece of goalkeeping.
He's also really good at catching. So yeah. It seemed easier to catch than punch.
Well, he came quite a long way to get a wide free kick swung into the box. And then it was almost like a batsman edging it, wasn't it? He managed to punch it behind him. But it did at least get enough distance on the punch that it went over his own bar. But it was strange because I thought Arteta was speaking like he was the one who was very commanding it at crosses. But it's a strange situation. I know this is a big hot topic, the Arsenal goalkeeping thing. But I think Arteta's just played it in a slightly weird way. Because what he's done, when you look at the selection, he's just brought in a new goalkeeper and made him number one. That seems quite clear cut. But the way he phrased it, like he was going to mix and match between these two keepers, or he said he, you know, had previously thought of subbing one on, one off. If you say that at the beginning, that constantly invites speculation about which one he's going to play. And I don't think that's very helpful for Raya. I mean, it's a big step up, Brentford to Arsenal, in terms of expectations, in terms of pressure, in terms of playing style. He's 28 as well, so it's quite a late jump. And he's been thrust into this with his manager saying, you know, inviting speculation about whether he'll start. Well, doesn't seem very helpful to me.
It is the hot topic, and we need a clip for the social. So say something controversial about Aaron Ramsdale maybe coming back in this weekend against his former side, Sheffield United.
Well, I don't think he'll come back yet.
Oh, no way.
I mean, Arteta's point is, what is the difference? Why can't a centre-back be under pressure to keep his place and a goalkeeper can't? And I'd never really thought about it that way, because it is such established wisdom that goalkeepers are different and they need the backing and stuff. And maybe things will change. Maybe they become more used to having that lack of certainty that all the other outfield players have.
I mean,
have to
I guess
with.
The end point is that, and we're probably heading that way, is that goalkeepers are so more valued for kicking that you just rotate any player in and out of goal as you feel like it, as in who are playing in the match.
As flying subs, you mean?
Yeah.
Olivier Giroud.
Yeah.
I mean, I completely agree with Rafa. I think it is a perfectly valid point and a perfectly valid thing for him to think.
But none of us are goalkeepers. They're different.
No, but to actually announce, you know, press conference.
He specifically said it was like a rotation thing.
He's, you know, he's actively made the decision to essentially replace the goalkeeper who was in the PFA team of the year last year. It's not like Ramsdale got injured, they signed a backup, and then there's a competition. He's brought someone in, said, right, I could sub you midway through a game. I think that does pile the pressure on Raya. But I think if he just brought him in and said, look, we're going to start him as my number one, which he has done, there wouldn't be so much pressure. But what he does need, he just needs a banana moment. You know, as Rafa said, one moment for Manchester United can transform the perception and his confidence levels. Raya just needs probably a couple of big saves.
Yeah, unless Arteta does bring back Ramsdale in a few games and does actually change them, it looks as if, as Michael said, he made a decision to change the goalkeeper, but sold it in a kind of novel, innovative way as, I'm not actually replacing my number one. I'm sort of opening up a race, and why should it be that we have a number one? Why can't they both? But I think he just kind of fudged the issue, maybe thinking that's going to take away from the fallout towards Ramsdale, because Ramsdale might still think, I have a chance. But
it's weird because
the public just started to, just would speculate even more as a result.
But it's weird because Arteta's not been shy in his time at Arsenal of getting rid of players he doesn't want, and maybe it is because Ramsdale is so popular. He's the fans really like him. He's Rambo, not actually Rambo.
Not actually. Right. Well,
did you see? By the way, this is slightly old news, but did you see Mikhailo Mudryk saying that the goalkeeping coach of Chelsea had told him Raya does come out of the goal quite a lot for crosses.
Right.
And that he actually aimed for a goal.
I did not see that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't know if I want to believe it. I mean, I believe the first bit that he was told he does come out. I'm not sure you can score a goal deliberately that way.
Because of Peruzzi against Borussia Dortmund back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, this clash with...
That wasn't a cross. That was clearly a shot.
But it was, again, they've been told.
Yeah.
He comes out, do him.
Lars Ricken.
Nice. Sheffield United are the opponents for Arsenal this weekend. Arsenal are unbeaten. Blades still winless. Sheffield United actually haven't won this fixture in a very long time. Do you know when?
Since 2 weeks after Mr. Tickle, the first Mr. Men, came out in 1971, which is interesting because that's right. a story about a man with mischievous arms.
Right.
And one of the most famous games between Arsenal and Sheffield United stemmed from Ray Parlour's throwing in the FA Cup, and they ended up replaying the game. So, just saying.
Do you know what else is weirdly appropriate about that last victory for Sheffield United away to Arsenal? Came in August 1971. Number one at the time was I'm Still Waiting by Diana Ross. I'm Still Waiting by Diana Ross was number one last time Sheffield United won away to Arsenal. And indeed, the Blades are still waiting for their first victory of the Premier League campaign. I am praying they give this game to Jonathan Pearson, match of the day, because what magic he will work with his intro.
He would like that.
He will indeed.
Never heard that Diana Ross song.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that song either.
I'm still waiting. Oh.
I mean, what a month. You could read Mr. Tickle, you could listen to that. Different times.
Different times. Different times. Hmm. Much like the fixtures on Sunday. All right. Elsewhere, what catches... Sorry. Elsewhere, what catches your eye? Perhaps it is 1 o'clock's West Ham Everton. Not a good week for the Toffees. I mean, first of all, on a very serious note, Chairman Bill Kenwright passed away on Tuesday. He'd been part of the board since 1999 and approaching 20 years as chairman of the club. Wednesday then, the news that the Premier League are considering a 12-point points deduction over this issue with alleged breaches of the financial fair play rules. Next up, they've got David Moyes as well. And the Hammers have got a terrific record against the Toffees. They've won 4 of the last 6 meetings. Big game for West Ham and Everton. West Ham got Olympiacos Thursday night. Are you pumped up for this one? Will this catch your eye as a neutral, Michael?
West Ham Olympiacos?
No, well, yeah, or West Ham Everton, more specifically. Mm. Yeah, why not?
It could be all right.
Okay, could be.
I mean, Moyes against Dyche is, you know, it wouldn't be top of my list, with all due respect.
But this is the new Moyes.
Yeah, bit like the old Moyes, I think.
Well, that game taking place early Sunday. But in the meantime, headlines for Everton filled with news of this massive-sounding 12-point deduction. This story's been out there for a while, but has the threat of a points penalty suddenly become much more real? Let's hear now from The Athletic's Matt Slater. Matt, you've been keeping an eye on this story. What's happened this week to prompt talk of a 12-point penalty?
Yesterday, which was Wednesday, the Daily Telegraph reported that the Premier League, who are one of the parties in this dispute, are asking for the maximum penalty, which is up to 12 points. And that has got, that's sort of exercised everyone's minds and prompted everyone to sort of, you know, react to that. I have already reported that the Premier League would be looking for a points deduction. I didn't know the number. And it's not really up to the Premier League. The whole point is this goes to a third party, this goes to an independent commission, and it's up to them to decide what the penalty is, and they have a whole range of things they can do, and they have sweeping powers. And I think the other thing to point out is that this is entirely unprecedented for the Premier League. It happens quite regularly in the English Football League, so we can look at loads of precedents where the EFL has charged a club with a breach of their financial fair play rules, which are very similar to the Premier League's. And the club has then defended itself in front of this panel, which are nearly always 3 people. And what's tended to happen is the EFL will ask for, I don't know, depending on the what they've done, 3 points, 6 points, 9 points. And the panel will go, OK, about half of that, and maybe we'll suspend some of it. So if there is a sort of series of precedents, it's of the league, if you like, the prosecutor, saying, we think this is a really egregious breach and we want 6 points. And the panel going, OK, let's hear the club's mitigation, and the club you know, making its points, maybe accepting some of them, disputing others and saying, all right, hold our hands up, but we did our best. And saying, okay, we'll go 3 points and maybe 3 points further suspended for a couple of years. So that's what tends to happen. The reason we are having this conversation today is that the Daily Telegraph yesterday said the Premier League want the lot. They want 12 points.
Okay, well, I guess a lot will depend on what kind of mitigation the Toffees can offer. Not sure how much is known about their defensive case. The disciplinary hearing did begin last week. The verdict is expected this year. Would you like to have a wild ballpark figure style pun on what you think is going to be the likely outcome?
Yeah, I will. I'm happy as long as we frame it in those terms. And it's a wild ballpark punt. I suspect they will be docked points, probably about six, but I suspect half of those will be suspended.
Oh.
So, you know, I think the Premier League has got itself into, well, it's under a lot of pressure from the other clubs. So that is part of this whole saga. And it is a saga. It goes back a long way. So the actual charge relates to a four-year period between 2018 and 2022. And the mitigation, well, we do actually know a fair amount about that. There's no dispute that Everton lost shed loads of money. They've been losing shed loads of money for 5-6 years. And they have, you know, if you just count up the numbers in their accounts, they have blown the allowed threshold of losses by a mile. You know, broadly speaking, they lost 370 million over that four-year period I mentioned, 2018-19 season to 21-22. You're allowed to lose 105 million over a three-year period. I've said it's four because the two COVID seasons are counted as one. So for the FFP purposes, you know, four becomes three. But they're miles over, three times over. Right, so what's their mitigation? What is their excuse? Well, first of all clubs are allowed to write off for FFP purposes certain expenses, your community, your women's team, anything you're doing on infrastructure, youth development. So there's always things that come off the loss. Now, the other two key bits for Everton, very Everton specific, are Everton is building a new stadium. Everyone knows that. It's very expensive. So you can write off costs related to that as part of that infrastructure spend. And then the controversial bit about Everton is that Everton claimed very high COVID-related losses. UEFA, EFL, Premier League, all the leagues said, all right, COVID was unusual and bad. We will make allowances for COVID-related costs. Everton's COVID-related costs were way, way higher than anybody else's. 170 million, they claimed. 103 million in one season alone. So they're saying that's things like, obviously, loss of matchday revenue for the season behind closed doors. But again, slightly uniquely for Everton, they're saying, well, look, we wanted to trade our way out of losses. We wanted to sell players. But at the moment we needed to sell players, the market crashed and there was no point selling our players. So that is a hit. And they've claimed that hit in their accounts. So that's part of their mitigation. That's where the row will be.
Brilliant. Matt, thank you so much for summing up a complicated situation. And verdict before the end of the year, you think?
Absolutely. Has to be. Because that whole point about justice delayed is justice denied. Various clubs think this should have been dealt with last season. It has to be dealt with quickly.
Matt Slater, talking about potential three-point hit for Everton, which would still sting, especially since they're only on seven at present, ahead of this weekend's clash with West Ham. Next up, might talk about Liverpool and the rest of the Premier League weekend.
Why are so many big stars missing from the Women's Champions League? Do we really need VAR in the women's game? Have Arsenal got too many players? Hello, I'm Sophie Penny, and I'm the host of the all-new Full Time Europe, The Athletic's women's football podcast. If you're a big women's football fan or a passing purveyor of the game, Full Time Europe is answering the questions you're asking. From Man United to Lyon, Barcelona to Wolfsburg, we have you covered. That's Full Time Europe, out every week, available wherever you're listening now.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Sports Podcast Awards Soccer Podcast of the Year.
Bamford takes it down for Somerville. Somerville! Yes! Oh, he scores! Crescencio Somerville stabs the ball into the back of the net.
Sunday at 2 o'clock, Liverpool take on Nottingham Forest, a year to the day since Liverpool last got beaten at Anfield in the Premier League. Can you remember who did it? Who got that last visiting win?
I've just read it.
Oh yeah, who was it?
It was Leeds United, Jesse Marsh. Last minute winner, wasn't it?
Mm.
I was at the game.
Oh yeah, right?
Yeah. Leeds were having a really good time in the dressing room. They were playing Saturday Night by
Wakefield.
Wakefield. Yeah, it's blasting out.
Why were they playing that?
Because it was Saturday Night and they won.
All right. Because it's Saturday Night and they like to party.
Jesse Marsh is doing the specific dance.
Duncan, Forest, I see, haven't won at Anfield since, do you know when?
Late 60s.
February 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Any popular game show, stroke children's
Tim Sherwood was a newborn baby, if you can imagine that.
I certainly can. Number one at the time was If Paradise Is Half As Nice by Amen Corner. The Amen Corners, I think they're traditionally hailed. Do you not know that? If Paradise Is Half As Nice As The Heaven That You Take Me To, Who Needs Paradise? I'd Rather Have You.
I've never heard of them.
What, Amen Corner?
Yeah
same.
Don't force me to sing this song. You must have heard this. If paradise is half as nice as heaven that you take me to. I think those are the words. Anyway, Liverpool host Toulouse on Thursday night in the Europa League. Hey, Villa are facing Luton Sunday at 2 o'clock. Duncan, thrill us with an Aston Villa stat.
They've won 11 home games in a row.
That's not the one I wanted.
Oh, what one do you want? Douglas Luiz?
9 games into 2023-24.
Mm.
And they are 4 goals short of their entire goals total.
From 2015-16.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Different times.
Yeah. Speaking of Tim, because was that a Tim Sherwood season?
He would have been involved that season. Right. Yeah, among many, a cast of thousands. But yeah, I mean, it was funny because we've talked about fixtures and scheduling and stuff, but last Sunday there were a few naysayers online saying, oh, it's the Super Sunday, Aston Villa, West Ham. It's actually a really good game.
Yeah.
And Villa are just really fun to watch. So
they've scored 17 goals in the last 4 home games and conceded only 3. And Luton, the latest team to try their luck there. Is that a game that catches your eye, although you can't watch it, Michael? What are you excited about this weekend?
Manchester Derby's good.
Yep.
Not the weekend, but I'm going to Brighton Ajax tonight.
I think that's
going to be really exciting.
That should be good.
I think it's one of the most romantic fixtures, if I can put it that way. It's
a shame that Ajax are totally rubbish at the moment.
Yeah.
Although, so Brighton. Brighton perspective.
Yeah. Brighton, I mean, strong favourites, I think.
Yeah.
Which, considering, I mean, I know it's an obvious thing to say, but
it would have been a ridiculous thing to say a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it does sound silly, doesn't it? I mean, I remember seeing Brighton play at the With Dean and, you know, struggling to see past the sandpit for the long jump to the action. And now they're playing Ajax.
The year Ajax won the European Cup in 94-95, Brighton lost in the FA Cup to lowly Kingstonian.
Never heard of them.
Mm. So that's very exciting.
That's amazing. Will there be a Fatboy Slim concert? Or is it only for the away games?
Is that a thing? I wasn't aware.
I think
that
they're pairing up the away games with Fatboy Slim.
Wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, well.
Good venues. Amsterdam, Marseille and Athens.
Yeah. Athens,
Very Eurotrance, I'd say.
Yeah, it's excellent.
Anything in particular wrong with Brighton, do you think? Because as you mentioned, they've gone off the boil a little bit.
No, but they have. I mean, they've suffered a couple of really bad injury problems this week. Solly March, it sounds like it's going to be out for a long time. And De Zerbi was quite vague about the prognosis, but it sounds quite bad. And Danny Welbeck as well is going to be out for a period. Whenever I've seen them, I think they've been slightly unfortunate not to get better results. But March is a blow. I think he was gearing up to have a really good season. He's so versatile as well. He's played almost everywhere. So I'm quite disappointed for him.
Okay, Brighton have Fulham at the weekend. That's on Sunday. Also this weekend, Chelsea taking on Brentford, who've actually won both of their Premier League visits to Stamford Bridge and are unbeaten in their last 12 Premier League London derbies. That's remarkable. Wolves are up against Newcastle. That could be a very interesting game. That's Saturday at 5:30. Wolves, one of the form teams, really, in the Premier League. Did you catch Gary O'Neill explaining how he works his magic against Bournemouth, his old club, but also how he beat Man City in great detail in that Monday Night Football Spurs-Fulham coverage?
Extraordinary detail, including footage from the training pitch, which is very rare. Yeah, I think a lot of people before thought maybe, you know, oh, the guest is Gary O'Neill, and then it was pretty interesting. I mean, you know, I think he was quite loquacious about his methods, shall we say.
It was like a presentation, a little bit. It was like almost like he was auditioning for a job.
Yeah, somewhere. Which is essentially what he did at Wolves in the summer and impressed them. So we kind of saw what Wolves saw. And I mean, the fact they're playing Newcastle is quite funny because I imagine the conversation between Gary O'Neill and Eddie Howe were incredibly intense coaching related. You know.
Bournemouth alumni, of course. They have that.
But I do think managers, often out-of-work managers, but also kind of rising managers, they do genuinely see Monday Night Football as like a bit of a shop window, don't they? I think you're maybe the fifth or sixth person to mention to me, oh, that Gary O'Neill, actually, he knows what he's doing. So, yeah.
Because you weren't previously convinced. I remember you controversially tweeting that Bournemouth were right to get rid of him in the summer.
Yeah, I did think it was worth them making a change. The calibre of manager you can get now, I think it is worth being quite harsh with those kind of steady eddies. Maybe that's unfair on Gary O'Neill, but it must be said it hasn't paid off so far. I've been proven wrong by Bournemouth's form so far this season.
Do you now think they should get rid of unsteady Iraola?
No, because I think he looked a really good manager in La Liga. And to be honest, I think there's so many poor teams in the Premier League this year. I think they'll probably come good. It's a very dramatic shift in terms of the football they're having to play.
Right.
So you do need to give it time, but they do need to get results quite quickly. And you think this weekend against Burnley.
This weekend is huge for Iraola, I'd say. I mean, they have been playing better than the results suggest. They were, Gary O'Neill didn't mention this, but they were a little unlucky against Wolves last weekend. But they really do need to beat Burnley. But I think, to Michael's point, I think Gary O'Neill, for instance, you can be a manager somewhere and maybe you're just doing the bare minimum, in a sense, to keep Bournemouth up. I think maybe that taught him that when he went to Wolves, maybe he needed to, you know, stick to his principles a bit more. And, you know, you can't just judge a manager in one job or one year. And, yeah, I don't know, it's interesting. But the lower reaches of the Premier League are, we've seen in the last few years, you know, Wolves got Lopetegui in and Villa, when they were down there, tempted Unai Emery. So there is, clubs don't need to worry if they get rid of someone who they can get in. There's plenty of options.
Okay. Is it fair to say that the last time these two teams met at the Vitality Stadium in the Premier League, it was statistically the worst game the Premier League has ever seen?
Yeah, five shots. Not great. Yeah.
What, on target?
No, five shots in total in the whole match.
There was a goal in the 89th minute.
Yeah.
Okay. There was only one shot on target. That was the goal. Why is this one regarded by Opta as the worst game in the competition's history?
Well, it's the lowest number of shots in a Premier League game since 2003. We discussed this before.
When people started points.
Yeah,
keeping note.
So
really, that's the lowest number of shots in a Premier League game?
I'm going to say there's going to be more than five shots in the first 20 minutes of this game. So I think this weekend's will sail past that one.
I don't want to be rude about your former employers because they're very helpful with our requests for statistics. But I remember Opta in the 1990s had like data on every player.
Yeah.
So how come they don't have that kind of data going back further than 2002?
So if you wanted seasonal totals, you could do it back to 96. But
shots?
Yeah.
Okay.
But in terms of dividing it per game and being able to run it for an individual match, due to an incredibly dull database-related thing, 2003 is the point.
Why? Okay. What happened to the... Did they upgrade
their system? It was a new system. It was a crazy time. Post.com boom. There were tech sales and everywhere. So it was exciting times. But yeah, that, as we said before, there are these weird sort of 03s, 1, 06, 07s, another one. There's these little weird cut-off points. But, you know...
1992 is the main one for me.
Well, that's when football started.
Hey, the Cherries have scored the fewest goals and have the worst conversion rate in the Premier League. And only Luton have produced fewer shots on target than Burnley this season. Anyway, they go at it 3 o'clock on Saturday in a game which will not be televised. Very good. Also this weekend, because I haven't mentioned it. Oh, no,
I mean,
I
it probably will That's be everything. Televised. It's just they weren't here. Broadcast.
Ah, right. It won't be televised.
I mean, maybe they'll just decide, actually, five shots last time. Let's say.
It will be televised, just not
It will encourage people to go to the local matches rather than the opposite.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm.
All right. Excellent. Where are you going this weekend, Michael?
Not at a game this week.
Are you not?
Actually, no.
Duncan, are Wickham up to much?
I'm probably going to Oxford, Wickham, yeah. And
are you?
M40 Classico. Yeah.
Very Big nice. Game. Best of luck with that. Raf?
Manchester Derby.
Are you?
Yeah, really excited.
Good.
Really excited.
All right.
Yeah.
Take an umbrella.
Looking forward to see Jeremy Doku.
Okay.
Doku.
Yeah.
Whichever way you want it. Mm. Playing in the flesh. It's good. Hopefully.
Mm. Hopefully so. Hopefully so. Well, good. Look forward to seeing how that game turns out. Of course, Sunday evening we'll be putting another Totally together with reaction to that and the rest of the weekend's action. But many, many thanks for being with us today, listener. And to Rafa, Michael, Duncan, Rachel and Charlie in the booth. And to Matt as well, short time ago. Have yourself a great weekend and we'll be back with you Sunday night, Monday morning.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.